The Guardian.
Terrorism hits London again, but the election goes on.
Theresa May declares enough is enough, while Jeremy Corbyn warns you can't protect Britain on the cheap.
With just 3 days of campaigning left, the party leaders are battling to show their credentials on security.
I'm Owen Jones.
And I'm Jonathan Friedland. And we're joined today by the editor of the monthly magazine Prospect and presenter of its Headspace podcast, our excellent former colleague, Tom Clark. So just 2 weeks after the bomb attack in Manchester and 2 months after the attack in Westminster, Londoners became the victim of terrorism once again on Saturday night. 7 people died and 48 were injured before the attackers were shot dead by police. In response, the Prime Minister, Theresa May, promised a step change in policy and set her sights on the internet companies who host extremist material. But that big statement, Owen, was the thing that caught everyone's attention, wasn't it? She comes out on the steps of number 10 in front of the lectern and gives a long statement, 6 or 7 minutes, I think.
Yeah, and the first part of that statement was absolutely fine, pitch perfect, arguably. It was doing what you'd expect from a party leader, a prime minister, in the aftermath of a despicable terrorist attack. You know, defiance, mourning those killed, celebrating the role of the police who so swiftly killed those terrorists. It was the second part that was the problem, because what she did after agreeing to cease campaigning for the day until the evening, which is when Labour lifted that pause, was to put forward party political proposals. There was a dog whistle about tolerating extremism in Britain for too long. And she said enough is enough. Now, some would know, well, I have and will again, enough is enough was on the banner of police officers protesting against cuts imposed by Theresa May, who has been Home Secretary for 6 of the last 7 years, 20,000 fewer police officers. And today, Karen Bradley, who ambled through a series of pretty bad interviews where she was asked repeatedly to confirm whether armed police numbers had fallen, she refused to answer, presumably because the fact is, according to the Home Office, they have, by about 1,000, in fact, compared to when the government came to power. And the reason, I suppose, people are saying Theresa May has questions to ask, Peter Kirkham, a former Met officer yesterday, saying the police service is in crisis as a result of cuts, that the government was lying over its claims repeatedly before that there were more armed police officers on the streets. And Theresa May in 2015 said the police federation was scaremongering and crying wolf over the impact of such cuts. So there's some of the reasons. It's also, we don't know yet, but the suggestions that some of the suspects, at least one, was known to the authorities. Steve Hilton, the former head of strategy for David Cameron, a devices figure, I think it's fair to say, but he's even called for Theresa May's resignation.
It's funny, the thing about the statement, I know exactly what you mean, and yeah, I've been doing a little thought experiment in my mind, was what's if these dreadful attacks had happened outside an election campaign, can I imagine her making that statement then? And I sort of can, because she did do, absolutely, as you said, the beginning was reaction to, and it is now, unfortunately, become a very familiar pattern of mourning the dead and praising the first responders. But then going into a prescription about what you would do about it, especially because there have been 2 in 2 weeks, I think a politician normally would do that. And the example I've got in my mind is Tony Blair saying, outside an election period, I think after 7-7, you know, the rules of the game have changed, which wasn't just boilerplate language. That was quite political language, saying I'm going to launch some new policy. But we've both had a go, so we should bring in Tom. What do you think? You know, was this a very, very political statement? Or maybe if it was it particularly kind of electioneering, do you think?
Well, I mean, first of all, I think politicians are political people. They're always thinking in a political way, and all the more so in an election campaign. They can say that they're suspending campaigning, but I think that they do that because the political calculation is that it makes sense to do so. I don't want to say they've got no human feeling about it. It's just I don't think they can switch the political brain off. I thought Theresa May's tone, actually, just hearing that, didn't sound swivel-eyed in the way that Tony Blair did when he was saying the rules of the game have changed. However, when you think about what she's proposing and how flaky the link back to what had actually just happened was, it was pretty dismal.
Oh, yeah, no, I wouldn't for a moment defend the substance of it, and I think hopefully we're going to get into that. I was just wondering about whether you do, because it's an election where you have to confine yourself only to mourning and sort of boilerplate, or whether you can talk about now what we're going to do. I don't know.
That's not my argument. I mean, actually, interestingly, after the Westminster attack, Amber Rudd, in a capacity as Home Secretary, said it would be wrong to rush very quickly to issue proposals in the immediate aftermath, which is what Theresa May did this time. But the point I was making is, yes, I'd expect, including in an election period, the Prime Minister to put forward proposals. But if you're calling for a moratorium on political campaigning, then what you should do in those circumstances is wait until after that ends, because otherwise what happens is the opposition is de facto gagged for several hours.
They can't respond.
They can't respond. They can't put forward their own proposals, or they'll be accused of politicising during a cessation, whilst the Prime Minister, standing, looking Prime Ministerial, behind the official insignia on Downing Street, she has free run to make those proposals.
It's pretty staggering when you reflect that a few weeks ago we were told that it wasn't possible for the government to unveil its latest analysis of the problem with air pollution and diesel, because that would be unduly political use of Whitehall during an election campaign that Whitehall's now used with the insignia in this more electric political way.
Let's talk about why she may have done what she did. There would be the one calculation, which I think is implicit in what Owen's been saying, which is it's political, and she wants to, you know, this was an opportunity. Her numbers have tanked in the last 2 weeks, and, you know, was this a political play to drive up her numbers? There's another thought going around, which is she just simply has taken an action, an attack on London more seriously than one on Manchester, because London's the capital, and there's the London bias of our political class that, you know, credible people are talking about that. And then the third thought, and I wonder if this is important, is just simply the fact that it's the second one. That with the first one, you know, you can sort of say, well, that's a horrible attack on Manchester, but it somehow treat it as if it were a one-off. Obviously, there was the Westminster Bridge attack a matter of weeks before. But when you've had two in 2 weeks, people expect you to say what you're going to do about it. They won't just take from you, just sort of, isn't it sad and isn't it awful, we must come together. They're going to want to hear some proposals from their Prime Minister.
Well, in that case, they should not have agreed to a moratorium on political campaigning. I mean, you know, there is a strong case for that. Some would go, well, we shouldn't let terrorism win by ceasing, you know,
campaigning at all. Yeah,
It shouldn't have the bigger the impact on democracy. That's a respectable argument, but it wasn't one that the Prime Minister signed up to. If she was going to make those arguments, you'd wait a few hours till 7 o'clock. It's not very long. After saying,
sure, but let's get into the motive of it. Why? What would you know? Do you think it's the London thing? Is it two in 2 weeks, or is it somebody thinking my numbers have cratered in these last 2 weeks and I need to do something, anything, to boost myself up?
I think it's quite clear that I'm going to say this sensitively, but clearly Theresa May has had, according to Ian Martin, who was a right-wing commentator, the worst Tory campaign since before the war, the First World War, he clarified. And therefore, to present herself at a moment of crisis as someone taking decisive action is clearly something that will play into her favour, given they calculate security is a strong card for the Conservatives in this election. So, of course. And the other point, you know, we're talking about, you know, on pollution, you said they can't publish that report because of the election. I mean, another issue is the report into funding of jihadi groups, which was supposed to be published last year. It was commissioned by David Cameron. It's believed to focus very heavily on Saudi Arabia, which Theresa May has got even closer to. And clearly that would be very embarrassing to the government, because the Saudis are a key ally, even though they export extremism. So I think these are all issues that have to be scrutinised. But the point is, it could have waited till 7 o'clock, which is what Labour did.
Tom, what about this line in her speech about, as if enough is enough, we've been doing all these various things wrong. And, you know, you heard Owen before saying a lot of people have been saying, well, who was Home Secretary for the previous six of the last 7 years? It was you were there. What is going on with that sort of claim by her? The only way I can imagine it makes sense, and you know, when you were here, you often wrote about Home Affairs and the Home Office. Was there any sense in which she had a view of how to deal with terrorism, but that she was somehow prevented from implementing? You know, could she push back and say, I didn't have full control when I was in charge of the Home Office? If I had been, I would have done X, Y, and Z, but I was stopped by David Cameron. We heard about Steve Hilton before. Is there anything in that at all that she could claim with some justification it wasn't me who was in full charge?
I mean, she's got a number of specific proposals that she could point to where, especially in the coalition time, she was diluted in what she wanted to do. So every terrorist incident, even if the people are on watch lists, as it seems in several of these last incidents, people have been, they want to go for what campaigners call the Snoopers Charter and what they'd call internet bulk surveillance. And that's come back again. There was an argument in the coalition years with something that was called control orders, which was the kind of New Labour alternative to internment, a form of house arrest, which was slightly brought into more regular kind of rule of law under something called TPIMS. And Theresa May resisted that. So on both of those, she could say, yeah, I've picked some arguments and now I want to go for the fuller-blooded version that I'd originally wanted to go for. But I think she's also doing something else, interestingly, which is trying to go beyond the kind of what are the particular law enforcement things I would like to do and open up a slightly broader kind of culture wars type approach, which is what Michael Gove was doing in his big famous spat with Theresa May a few years ago, where he talked about draining the swamp and ended up with a couple of Theresa May's advisors having to resign. It was quite a serious argument.
And just to explain, who was on which side in that?
So Theresa May was much more on the, like, I'm in the Home Office, I want to do this, that and the other because I know how they work, whereas Michael Gove was, no, we need to go in and have a ideological kind of war. Whereas when she was talking about, you know,
so it sounds like she's become more Govite in her speech
yesterday. I think she's become more Govian, yeah.
Which is not just get the odd crocodile, as it were, but actually drain the entire swamp in some sort of bigger cultural way. That's what Gove was always saying, and her speech implied that she was coming to that side of the argument.
I think it had a little bit of that, and within hours of it, Ian Duncan Smith, okay, he's not in the cabinet at the moment, but he popped up on the radio saying, you know, this idea we need to have embarrassing or awkward conversations, what does that mean? They were linking it with this idea that in lots of Muslim communities there's been a lot of child abuse, which is something that's received a lot of coverage elsewhere. Perhaps that's right, but I'd say that's quite a different issue.
No, it's interesting. I mean, what's interesting at the moment is the police force, or those police officers speaking out, are suggesting they have the adequate powers, but the problem is numbers. It's resources. Cressida Dick today, the Metropolitan Police Commissioner, argued, for example, that, well, she was pressed, but she's difficult for her because she can't intervene in a general election campaign, but they needed more resources. But, you know, David Alan Green, for example, the lawyer, the legal expert, suggests that he can't think of any new legislation on terrorism which would in any way help. There's ample legislation on terrorism. But just that point about, in terms of extremism, Prevent is the flagship programme which the Tories have on monitoring, supposedly, levels of extremism. The public sector has a duty responsibility, for example, in schools, to detect levels of extremism. But it's, as a report by a select committee pointed out, it was toxic and many would argue counterproductive. What do you think on Prevent?
Well, I just think, I mean, what you really do not want with jihadism is you do not want it to be harboured across whole communities, whole streets, in the way that Irish republicanism was mainstream across parts of West Belfast. That's when you've really lost, if you've got whole sections of cities.
But that hasn't happened.
And that hasn't happened at all. And in fact, the perpetrator in Manchester, lots of people had given warnings to the authorities. But I think if you go too heavy on the kind of sense that everyone's teacher is a spy on your child, then it would be easier to see yourself getting into a world where there's much wider support for it in the community.
And when you say teacher, that is what was behind her reference to the public sector, was
public
it?
Public sector duty, yeah.
She meant, because I was wondering about prisons, perhaps, but whether she was including that. But you think schools was in her mind in that?
I don't know. I mean, prisons are a different case, because obviously people are kind of beyond being in surveillance by the time they're in prison.
Yeah, although we know that they can somehow, it said, incubate and win over people who were previously pretty neutral on these issues to kind of extremist ideology.
But I think it's fair enough to be spying pretty hard on people once they're already
in prison. And you don't mind having embarrassing conversations there.
Cressida Dick as well today, interestingly, raised the issue of mental health. And actually, in terms of the profile of those susceptible to extremist ideology, they're often troubled men with levels of mental distress, anxiety, depression, histories of petty theft, violence, particularly against women, drugs, alcohol. So that's another interesting route, which Cressida...
Yeah, I think that's well worth looking at. And, you know, it's easy to just talk about either police numbers or police powers. I think we should think more about, you know, the kind of Bowling for Columbine type cases. You know, what makes young men go on the rampage much more generally?
All right, we're going to keep talking about this after the break. For the moment, you can leave us your thoughts on our podcast page and follow the latest on the investigation and, of course, the election at theguardian.com.
So last night, as promised, Labour broke off their pause on campaigning after the despicable terrorist atrocity. Jeremy Corbyn did a speech up in Carlisle. For my money, that was the best speech I've seen him give. I mean, he spoke in terms of the priority must be public safety, backed whatever actions necessary and effective to protect the security of people in Britain, giving full authority to the police to use whatever force is necessary. Made it clear, obviously, the 20,000 police cuts and the danger that posed to the public, that they'd recruit 10,000 more, but also made a passionate plea about, in terms of democracy must triumph over extremism, that terrorism can't derail our democracy, disrupt the election. That's critical, because if they seem to have an impact on our democracy, that will incentivise others, of course. And he also made the point about our relationship with the Saudi regime, its exporting of extremism, and demanded the publication of that report, which was supposed to be published last year, into foreign funding of jihadism. What do you think?
No, I thought it was an effective intervention too. The question I've got, and I also thought he handled the foreign policy thing. He did, you know, I think if he'd gone more into the speech he made after Manchester, which did talk much more about foreign policy, I think that would have just felt a little bit too soon. I think he navigated that quite deftly. The question I have in my mind is about how this works for each of them. On the one hand, as you said before, obviously she, Theresa May, gets to be the Prime Minister standing in Downing Street. And you would think automatically, just going through his, you know, historically, security would be a strong suit for the Conservative Party anyway. But as a former Home Secretary, part of her image, you know, before this campaign eroded it, was that she was sort of strong and secure. You would automatically think this would work for her. But this issue of police cuts, these numbers, you know, does he have a very strong suit there, Corbyn and Labour, in going to say we would have been safer if the Conservatives had not cut police numbers? And does that mean that, in effect, it's sort of neutral for both of them? I don't know. Or what do you think, Tom Clark? Is that, you know, when you're in an environment like this where there's been an attack 4 days before a general election, I don't know whether we've ever had that before in British history. I think we haven't. You know, does that automatically favour A, the incumbent, and B, particularly a Conservative party?
Well, I think the Guildford pub bombing was just a few days before the October 74 election, maybe 5 days before. So, and that was Labour came in with the expected increased majority, but maybe a bit less of an increase than expected. I don't know if it had any bearing. My own feeling is, I'm afraid that people hear these arguments about powers and policing going back and forth, and that the arguments will cancel out, but that really people will be more inclined to look at Jeremy Corbyn favourably, where he can get issues other than terror and security up the agenda. He's given as, you know, good an account as he was going to after Manchester, and now by very kind of gently and kind of tactfully making the link to foreign policy. But I think whether or not there have been distortions involved, and there have been many distortions involved, people have in their mind that it's the guy who's a bit iffy on shoot to kill, who's sort of not the most patriotic. And I think really he would want people to be talking about the health service and
rather
security service.
So you mean just the fact the agenda has shifted is bad for him, because it's on a topic? Which
it's on a topic where he's a long
way. I mean, one thing I noticed, it's a small thing, but I just thought, you know, if you were in Team Corbyn, this would not be what you'd want to see. But on the most viewed list of the BBC website video, the most viewed video was that exchange with Laura Koonsberg from 2015 about shoot to kill, that clip in which he says, you know, I'm not comfortable with it.
She did get censored though, didn't she, by the BBC Trust, I think.
She did. They said it was unfair. And he did obviously clarify immediately that he reported that shoot to kill in that
particular case.
So the argument was it was distorted what was presented.
Yeah, there was a slippage there between what asking about a hypothetical principle and about the particular case, I think. And so it was misunderstood, or people, you know, he certainly said it was misunderstood. But, you know,
the BBC Trust.
You know, fact that the video is being looked at again, I thought would be troubling for him.
Well, on that, yeah, I mean, it's true, obviously, in Labour's case, if voters are, you know, going in thinking about terrorism and security rather than social care, the dementia tax, the NHS tax, justice or whatever, then that's not going to help Labour's case probably. I mean, on that, on the videos issue, we'll see the impact, of course, in a few days, but the Tories are running a very effective campaign, particularly on Facebook, Instagram for that matter.
And this is where this clip incidentally was being shared very heavily.
It was a video selection of you know, very selective edits of things Jeremy Corbyn has said relating to security. And they're pushing that very, very heavily. And it's kind of under the radar, because what you'll see, I mean, this is where I worry a bit about what happened yesterday in terms of the pause on campaigning, because clearly the online campaign didn't end. Those Facebook videos just goes on and on and on, yeah. reaches a huge amount of people. That Labour just don't have the resources and money to match that at all.
But you know, but on my point about the 20,000 police cuts, I do think that must help and help Labour and hurt her. That is a powerful case, that there would have been more police on the streets had she and the Tory government not cut them. And that's quite an easy thing to understand as well. It's not a complicated policy point in the way that some of the stuff about prevent and all that can be complicated. People get the idea that there are just too few police around. And I just wonder if that will help Labour's case and help Jeremy Corbyn.
Well, I suspect personally it wouldn't have made much difference. I also suspect that people don't pay attention that much to the policy argument. I overheard someone in a motorway service station yesterday saying, but the thing people don't know about him is he's friends with Hezbollah. And, as I say, I think there's a lot of slurs around some of this, but I just think, like, if the mood is that you want a kind of crackdown, then Jeremy Corbyn's probably not your man. And it doesn't matter whether actually he might be able to offer a more effective crackdown because he's putting more money in. I just think you'd want to change the subject. The only thing I could say in terms of comfort for Labour at the moment is that I expected a big shift in the polls after Manchester for the same reason, and we didn't get it. The Corbyn mini surge continued.
Yeah, I mean, again, and this is a running theme, I suspect of this election, there's a generational divide on the issue, for example, of security as well. I mean, there's a huge, unprecedented, according to the polls, gap in generational opinion in terms of the Tories have a huge lock on older Britons and younger Britons. Labour have an unprecedented lock. Obviously, that helps the Conservatives because those older people are more likely to vote and they're often in seats which are more problematic for Labour in terms of this election. But on security, there is that divide. But that's all we've got time for on that issue now. Before we go, though, a daily dose of recommended reading. We'll link to all those pieces on the podcast page. Johnny, today, what's caught your eye?
Well, it's a blog, and we have apologised before. We've sounded the nerd klaxon, I think, before. This would have to be like a triple nerd klaxon with extra wonk effects, because this is by a statistician called Nigel Marriott, who has his own blog. And he has really taken the deepest of deep dives into the polling and why there are variations, etc. And it ends it with his own seat forecast, which maybe, you know, I won't spoil it for you, but it probably won't cheer up too many Labour optimists, his forecast. But it's so meticulous and methodical as a statistician about the different weighting that goes on. And one thing he does that's particularly interesting is he sees how areas that voted Leave, he accounts for those areas that voted Leave. He gives them an extra sort of push in terms of likelihood for Conservatives to win seats in those areas. So he's devised a very elaborate model. It's deeply nerdy, but it actually explains some of the variation in the polls and explains why some of what you're seeing in the polls, you're just not hearing back from people who are out on the doorstep. And I've been talking all the time to chiefly Labour people who are, you know, campaigning in the Northeast, campaigning in Yorkshire, and they are just not what they're seeing doesn't quite fit the impression of the, this very, very narrow gap in the polls. And this piece by Nigel Marriott explains some of that disconnect, I think.
Unfortunately, I've got a very similar piece or a very similar theme, which is in the Financial Times, Jim Pickard and George Parker, Labour brace for significant losses in North and Midlands. And that's based on a survey of Labour candidates on the doorstep. And the issue is, I suppose, with that poll surge is where those votes are. In the big cities, Labour's doing very well indeed. That's what's been suggested, London, Manchester and elsewhere, that Labour already have, of course, most of those seats. I mean, hypothetically, Labour might be in a position to even gain in London if the polling is correct. One poll suggested by YouGov that Labour's on the same result now as they got in 1997 when Tony Blair had a historic landslide. You know, it's difficult to imagine that, but that's what it says. I suppose, you know, on that, some would go, well, some of these Labour MPs don't like Corbyn. It's in their interest to say that. I don't know, downplaying expectations at this point, so that helpful for them. So I suspect it's based on an honest view of what's on the doorstep. Some are suggesting whether or not, you know, field operations are detecting properly some of the people who haven't voted before and younger voters. We'll see about that. But my own view is, because this is saying, you know, privately they think 180 seats for Labour, even though I desperately want Labour to do well, I'm fully aware of all the odds stacked against the party in this election. And the only way that can be turned around to any degree, particularly with those younger and non-voters, is to have a formidable get-out-the-vote campaign in the last few days. That's what Labour's hopes now hinge on. And we'll see if that's enough. Otherwise, of course, Labour will suffer severe losses, but we'll see. I mean, I have to be optimistic, don't I? Hope for the best, expect the worst.
Mm. I'm spending a lot of my time reading similarly nerdy and mostly depressing articles as well, but I'm going to recommend something quite different, which I think is insightful and will be good to have in your mind, whichever way the election goes, as you try and make sense of it, which is a piece we ran in Prospect by someone called Paul Hilder, who has worked with Steve Hilton, who's in the news, as we've discussed, for other reasons today. And it's called The New Politics, The Revolution Will Be Digitized. And what I think is interesting about it is it covers the effect of disruptive digital networks on the crazy politics of the last couple of years from a couple of different angles. So on the one side, it's got the Trump and Cambridge Analytica stuff, which might be relevant if the Tories romp home, and if Owen's right that there's been all kinds of sinister feeds on Instagram or whatever shaping the way people think. But if, on the other hand, the Labour Party does better than expected, and I think that will need some explanation given Corbyn's failure to play by any of the ordinary rules of the game. And Paul Hilder's got this argument about networked politics, more horizontal rather than top-down politics, that's facilitated by the internet, which he says the rest of us haven't got our heads around yet, and only people like Bernie Sanders and their campaigns have. So maybe Corbyn, if you're looking for a Labour optimistic angle, will be able to use a bit of that.
Well, thanks for that. And I'm afraid that is it for today. Make sure you're subscribed to Election Daily wherever you get your podcasts. And do follow us all on Twitter at Guardian Audio. Owen is at OwenJones84. Tom is at Prospect_Clark. No E on the end. And I'm at Friedland.
We are back tomorrow. Thank you to Tom Clark. Fantastic stuff. Our producers are the wonderful Phil Maynard and Gabriella Jones. Do give them a round of applause at home for all their hard work. And thank you for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.